welcome to the Semiconductor Insiders Podcast Series. The goal of this podcast is to bring semiconductor experts together to get to the truth about the matter at hand. We'll get right to the point and not exceed 30 minutes of your time. If you have a topic you would like us to cover, please post it on semiwiki.com and we'll get right to it. Good morning. With me today is my podcast partner, Mike Gianfagna, and our guest is Ray Zinn, the longest serving CEO in Silicon Valley. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Dan.
And good morning, Ray.
Hey, good morning to you both.
Ray, I follow you on LinkedIn. It's a pleasure to speak with you. I grew up here in Silicon Valley, and I know most of the local semiconductor stories, so I'm very interested in hearing yours. But first, let's start with how you got into semiconductors.
Okay, so I graduated in 1960. I had my degree in industrial engineering and management and came to the Bay Area because actually I was engaged to a gal who lived here, and we subsequently broke up, but she got me started at a company called United Technology, which was a company that made rocket motors for the shuttle. Then met my wife, and her father had started Fairchild in 1961, and he was in the calibration lab where they calibrated thermocouples that profile the furnaces. He said, "Oh, you got to come over. It's a fantastic industry and one that I think you'll enjoy." And so I left United Technology in 1963 and joined Fairchild Semiconductor, and was over in the Wisman building, which is on Wisman Road, which kind of is perpendicular to Highway 101. Over in that building, we had, you know, Bob Noyes and Charlie Spork and Don Yost and folks like that. I was only maybe 100 feet from their office. And then they had the Palo Alto Research Center. That's where Moore and Greenwich and guys like that were stationed. And that's kind of the end of it. I actually got involved in the, you know, wafer fab manufacturing portion of Fairchild. We had a little tiny 3/4 inch wafer line. It was really funny to think now we're up over 12 18 inches or whatever we are now, but we were only like 3/4 inch wafer. I mean, it was a real milestone to be able to do 1 inch wafers. So that's the early part. We made transistors. We made NPN and PNP transistors. And there's a guy named Jack Gates that was over just a little south of me in the building that was starting to do integrated circuits. And so we made our first integrated circuit in 1964. And I remember that day very well because we had a big celebration. Jack actually jumped up on his desk and started playing his violin. Really kind of funny. So anyway, it was a kind of a interesting time. We had to make all of our own process equipment. And I got involved in that, making some of the equipment that we use in manufacturing semiconductors, like epi reactors and so forth. And so that was a fun time for me. I enjoyed that very much.
That's amazing. How long were you at Fairchild?
I was at Fairchild until 66. Then I went to a company called Amelco or Teledyne, was there, you know, for quite a while, and then went to a company called Nortec Electronics, which was a startup over right next to National Semiconductor.
That's amazing. You know, we've done a podcast on Fairchild with another Fairchild employee, John East, and it's just amazing to see how many people from Fairchild, Fairchild spawned the semiconductor industry, at least here in Silicon Valley, because if you trace the roots to all these different companies, they all come back to Fairchild. Let's talk about Micrel. So everybody knows Micrel. Micrel had one of the longest runs in Silicon Valley. I think it was 1978 or late 70s, right?
78.
You founded Micrel?
78.
So what made you do that? How did it get started? And you know, step me through the early parts of it.
Okay, so I was actually making digital watches at the time. My first product I made was a digital watch, a runner's watch. You can actually look it up in Jim Fix's second book of running. I'm actually listed in there because I made the very first runner's watch. And I was working with a company called Nortec Electronics, which is a company I used to work for before I went to Electromask. And, you know, I'm the one that actually came up with the wafer stepper, the design of the wafer stepper. And so then I left Electromask and started, you know, messing around with consumer electronics, the Pong games with Atari and digital watches and stuff. So I actually was going to go into consumer electronics. But then I got this bright idea of, because people were starting to use fabs and other services. So I said, why can't I start a semiconductor company that we just use everybody else's equipment and we just get the designs and build the product ourselves? So that's how I got started. I couldn't or didn't get any venture capital. I started with my own money. The bank loaned us the money, but said we had to be profitable from day one, because they weren't going to loan to a startup. And so we had to come up with a service business. So I bought a couple of Century testers, the Fairchild Century testers, and I began doing testing services and did that for some time, using other foundries to make my wafers and so forth. And they weren't foundries. So like Electronic Arrays wasn't really a foundry, but I got them to make me some wafers using our plates. And then from there, I bought the Siemens/Electronics fab, which in the very beginning, back in 71, my brother actually started it. It's called Advanced LSI. It was a fab over on Pastoria in Sunnyvale. So we found out that Siemens was getting rid of that fab. And so we made an offer on it, they wanted $1.6 million for the whole fab, lock, stock, and barrel. It was a 3-inch fab, had all this old equipment, I mean, really old equipment, but that's all I could afford. And so then from there, I negotiated them down to $1.1 million and ultimately actually ended up paying for it for $900,000. Because of the they wanted to terminate the wafer agreement they had with us, because we were supposed to build wafers for them for a period of time, they canceled our contract, and so in so doing they actually lowered the price to $900,000. So I actually got into a wafer fab for $900,000.
Wait a minute, great. So in theory, I mean, was Micro the first fabless semiconductor company?
I can't say that I was the first, because I think there was one other company in the back east that had preceded us. I'm trying to remember their name. They're no longer around, but we might have been the second, and I can't be sure of that. If you look at the whole world, I mean, know that we were one of the first to be fabless. But then we bought our own fab. We bought that electronics fab for, as I said, ultimately for $900,000. And then we won in 92. We bought the SEEQ, S-E-E-Q fab over on the Fortune Drive. That's the fab where we ultimately ended up. It was a 4-inch. We converted it to a 6-inch in the early 90s. So that's kind of the sequence of events of Micrel and kind of how we got into to being a having our own fab. And the reason we have our own fab is because which may lead into the conversation that you guys want to have today, because we believe you can't really differentiate yourself in design. You can only really differentiate yourself in a process, you know, and because, you know, they can copy your design as long as they have the same technology that you're using. So what we tried to do was develop a technology that wasn't, you know, as universal around the world as you would, and that would give us an edge so that our designs could not be so easily copied.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, when I started in the early 80s, it was the computer manufacturers that were kind of driving semiconductors. So all mm-hmm. the companies, I worked for Data General, and there was Digital Equipment and IBM, of course. And, you know, we all had our own fabs and did our own chips. And that's how we differentiated. And, you know, when Intel and Motorola came out with microprocessors, that kind of put us out of business. In fact, it did put us out of business. I remember Data General pivoted and tried to use the Motorola CPUs for their computers. but you know, we had no real differentiation than the other folks. And some of the younger companies like Sun Microsystems were much more agile and you know, took out all the mini computer companies, right? Things seem to be changing, Ray. I mean, you know, it's very expensive to have your own fab these days. You know, what's your take on the situation? Do you think, well, you were around when AMD had their own fabs, right? And then AMD all of a sudden decided to be fabless.
Well, yeah, absolutely. No, I know that history very, very well. So what really happened in my mind was the environmental pressures from the local government, from Santa Clara, the county of Santa Clara, and to the cities in San Jose, making it so difficult for us to manufacture wafers in Silicon Valley. And so we started looking elsewhere. We started looking at other places to put in facilities. You know, they moved to Phoenix and Dallas was already in existence, but some companies moved to Dallas, others moved to Austin, and some up in Minneapolis and Colorado, Utah. Actually, Signetics moved their fab over to Orem, Utah, Beaverton, Oregon. We were just moving out of the Bay Area. That was kind of, I think, the beginning of the end of wafer manufacturing in Silicon Valley. The only ones that really were sticking around were the ones that were the analog companies like myself, Maxim, Linear Technology, and folks like that, because we didn't need 12-inch wafers. Number one, number two, our technology was very, very process dependent, and so we kept our fabs. And so with the integration of these analog processes, you know, what we call PMICs. I don't know if you're familiar with that term. Those are power management integrated circuits. Is that what that stands for? Yeah. The PMIC really came into power, and so that required you to integrate a lot of digital with the analog. In fact, and when I was talking with Intel back in the late 80s, Intel said that they could see a time when power management was going to be more important actually than the digital portion of the computer, and so today these PMICs are very, very important, power management integrated circuits, but they have a lot of digital. They're also very intelligent. They require some microprocessing, and so that then, you know, promoted these companies like TSMC and SMIC and some of these other offshore fabs to start developing processes that could do analog along with digital. And so, you know, I think just the migration from a pure analog process to a more combined analog/digital process has really opened the doors up for these foundries. Now, I'm not speaking about, you know, the sub 7-nanometer, you know, processes. I'm talking about, you know, stuff that's still, you know, 18 nanometer, not a 12 nanometer. So those processes are available now around the world to do PMICs. All these companies now basically have analog/digital technology. And we've promoted that. I mean, we've, because of the way that the technology has advanced, we have been giving the technology away, basically. And so all these outside foundries now have very sophisticated analog/digital technology.
What's happening now, Ray? I mean, it looks like maybe even Intel is going to, you know, outsource some of their products, making processes is much more difficult. You know, there's only maybe three companies that are going beyond, 7-nanometer now, right?
I mean, I don't know how analog is going to integrate down below, say, 9-nanometer. So we're going to have to see. You know, I mean, it's again. The world seems to be able to adapt, and we are producing, you know, a lot of analog technology on digital processes. What concerns me more is that both South Korea and China have in their roadmap that by 2025, they are going to produce 95% of all of their own semiconductors. As you know, the world's largest right now is Samsung semiconductor. You know, IBM has backed off. They used to be the big gun. In fact, you know, up until, you know, probably the early 90s, IBM was the largest manufacturer of semiconductors. It's and you guys still have TI. TI's, you know, still has their own fabs, not in the Bay Area, but in the Dallas area. And they, I don't think they're below 90 nanometer yet. I think they're still 120 nanometer or something like that. I'm not positive, but anyway, and they're moving into gallium arsenide and other types of substrates. So, you know, everybody's trying to find out, you know, how they can differentiate themselves. You still have the large fabs in Europe still exist. I don't know about Siemens. They may have backed off. But it seems like, of course, the world's largest is as far as fabs are TSMC in Taiwan. Things are going to change dramatically, I think, in the next 3 or 4 years, because we're going to have to make the decision whether or not we're going to still own the semiconductor world, or if we're going to let that forego to South Korea and China.
Yeah, I you know, I follow you on LinkedIn. I see you mentioned China exit or Chen exit or something.
Right, Chen exit.
You've been promoting for some time the exit from China, mm-hmm. based on the problems that we're having today, as a matter of fact, right? You know, our supply chain is constrained because of the issues we have with the U.S. and China, and actually the whole world in China. So some of the things you've been talking about for the last few years seem to have come to the forefront of our industry.
You know, if we can somehow or another get our government to limit the process technology from leaving the U.S., I think we have the ability to stay the leader in electronics. As I have said and on many instances, the country that owns semiconductors owns electronics. The company that owns country that owns electronics owns the GDP, in other words, the growth, because electronics is the key to the growth of a country. And in fact, we look at the issues today, the shortage of semiconductors. The automotive people are just dying, because they've committed so much now to semiconductors with this COVID problem, has, you know, shortened, collapsed the supply. And, you know, these guys are screaming. Yeah, and I think the government is trying to step in and see what they can do to push some of that inventory over to the automotive folks, because the automotive industry is very important to our country. But it won't be long until the cost of a vehicle will be primarily electronics, as opposed to, you know, body paint, tires, and stuff like that. You have Tesla, which is 100% electronics, except for the body and the tires and so forth. And so, you know, that seems to be the wave of the future, is that whether it be a refrigerator, or whether it's going to be a car or whatever, it's going to be dominated by electronics. Even today, I mean, if you look at all the systems we have, whether it be the cloud or the whatever other thing that holds our network together, it's really electronics or semiconductors, which are the heart of electronics, are the key. So we have to protect that technology. And the way to do that is, of course, not let AMAT and KLA and people like that sell to those countries our new technology, our new processing capability.
Yeah, you know, when I started semiconductors, my family had no idea what I did for a living, and they didn't really care. And it really wasn't until smartphones came out that my kids started understanding how important my work was and what I actually did for a living. And you're right. I mean, modern electronics is a key to life, you know, modern life. Yeah. And you know, the one thing I have concern about is cutting off semiconductors to any country is like cutting off, you know, water or food or oil or something, because you really can't function without electronics today. And cars is an example. And, you know, you mentioned Tesla. I have not heard any delays or complaints from Tesla about getting chips. And I think you're going to find is that Tesla uses modern process technologies where most automotive companies don't. Right, you know, they still are heavily analog mixed signal. They're on the 200 millimeter fabs versus the new ones, and Tesla is using FinFETs, right? So there's a lot more capacity because Apple, you know, builds huge amounts of capacity for their phones, and then they go on to the next process every year, and they leave behind, you know, plenty of fab space. But some of the other automotive companies didn't move forward, and you're right, you know, China has a lot of 200 millimeter fabs, and we do get a lot of parts, and our supply chain is dependent on China. So I think this is a realization that we're just now experiencing, but you and I and some of the other people around the industry saw it coming. But is the US going to build fabs? I mean, you heard some talking from the government. You know, is Intel going to continue to build fabs in the US? And, you know, what are we going to do about this?
Well, I think if I just said this a few minutes ago, that if the government will step in and limit the sale of the highest or the most unique technology to other countries, that will help, or at least countries that are not favorable to our country. So, you know, it's like we don't allow sales of just anything to those countries. I remember when I invented the wafer stepper, that was highly protected by the US. And what happened was we sold the doggone stepper to, I think it went from Germany to Austria to Hungary, and then it got copied by, you know, the Soviet Union, because I have one of my employees at my Krell used to work at that Hungarian Soviet Union company. And he said they just took the stepper that we had and they copied it. And so that's how the Soviet were able to keep up with the US technology, was by copying our stepper. And so, you know, we limited, you know, you say, well, you know, we don't want to hurt any country, but we limited the Soviet Union from having access, because again, a lot of the technology we have is for defense, and they'll give us an advantage in protecting our country, whether it be, you know, with security devices or technology protecting our internet. I still think it's important for our country to protect our technology.
Yeah, I definitely do. You know, the concern I have is that, you know, we ship all this equipment to South Korea, we ship all this equipment to Taiwan, and, you know, we're on very good relations with Taiwan. They really control the semiconductor manufacturing right now, at least for the leading edge. But, you know, China has some type of rights to Taiwan in their mind, and that could change. You know, if China did, you know, pressure Taiwan or take over Taiwan, you know, TSMC would cease to exist, because it's an ecosystem of the entire world that produces these semiconductors, not just one company. But, you know, I guess what I was getting at is, you know, is the U.S. going to be able to invest in technology here? You know, I remember the environmental issues when I worked at the fab in Silicon Valley. My wife and I were having children, and she looked around and she saw, you know, that the water tables were maybe not the cleanest right near where I worked. So we actually moved far away. We moved to Danville. So we moved to the East Bay to have children. But, you know, that's really not the case anymore. You know, most of the fabs I'm in are very green. They say that the water is cleaner going out of the fab now than it is coming in. So, you know, I don't see any reasons not to be able to build fabs and manufacturing back in the United States, with the, you know, exception of cost, because most countries like Korea and Taiwan, the governments are partners with, you know, these companies, and, you know, enable the building of these fabs and such. And the U.S. just hasn't done that, but maybe they can. But I don't see any reason why we can't bring manufacturing back to the United States, you know, back to when, you know, you were starting Micrel and back in the old days when we controlled manufacturing, because the semiconductors really did, you know, start in the United States, and specifically Silicon Valley was the hub, really.
I agree. You know, it's again, it's up to, you know, the supply of supply and demand of of semiconductors. So if it looks like it's getting hostile in some of the foreign countries, then I think the government will be forced to rebuild here in the U.S. You know, it's hard to read the tea leaves because it's a lot of politics involved, and politics is the most difficult thing to understand and predict. So I do know that the more automation we get in manufacturing semiconductors, the more cost effective it will be to move that technology back to fab back to the U.S. So I have hopes that within the next 5 to 10 years that the industry will have moved back, at least in part, back to the U.S.
This has been a great conversation. I've enjoyed the scenic tour of semiconductors. By the way, Ray, I joined the world when it was three inches. I remember I worked at RCA. There was a 3-inch silicon on sapphire pilot line. So that was a starting point for me. It has changed a lot, hasn't it, over the years?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Well, you know, we've tried everything. We tried germanium. Then we went to silicon, and I think they've looked at sapphire. Sapphire is, of course, quite expensive. Yep. Silicon carbide, indium phosphide. I mean, gallium arsenide. I mean, we've tried everything, and I still believe that there's a lot of room to grow. I just hate to see the process technology move out of the Silicon Valley, out of the Bay Area. You know, I get calls and people asking me all the time, how can we start Silicon Valley outside of Silicon Valley? Silicon Valley has become more like Software Valley,
right,
as opposed to Silicon Valley. So, you know, there just was such a unique environment back in the 60s and 70s and 80s, you know, as we were growing the industry, and it was a lot of excitement. And, you know, I've known every leader in semiconductors in the Bay Area. So some were very good, some were not so good. So I do agree that it is the CEO, I think, that really helps maintain the longevity of the company.
So this is a good stopping point. Thank you, Ray. This is a great conversation. We hope to have you back. There's a lot more topics we can certainly cover. You can catch Ray on his website, toughthingsfirst.com. You'll find blogs, you'll find podcasts, you'll find his books. That's the best way to get in touch with Ray. We'll stop now. And again, Ray Zinn, the longest serving CEO in Silicon Valley. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Ray.
Well, thank you, guys. Appreciate you letting me on this program.
That concludes our podcast. Thank you all for listening, and have a great day.